another startup speaker series. I'm really excited about today. I get very excited, Joy, when we have alumni in the room. So please join me in welcoming UC Davis alumna Joy Fan to Startup Speaker Series.
Thank you, guys.
All right, now Joy, I intentionally don't give your introduction because that's how I'd like to start the conversation.
Sure.
Can you do a long introduction from starting off in college and what you were studying in college?
Do we have that much time, Dawn? No, because
yes, we do. Yeah, and hear a little bit about your career path up to your first startup.
Sure. Yes. Hi, everyone. Such a pleasure to meet you all. I know you're all wearing masks and I'm appreciative, safety first. But I can see some of your smiling eyes. So that's fantastic. Such a pleasure. I did go to UC Davis. If anyone lived at Sereno Hall, that's where I lived in the dorms my first year. Really enjoyed the experience. I did actually come in as a biology student and then switched over as a double major of design biology and then switched fully over to environmental design with a minor in marketing. So that was my path in terms of the education system. But I will say a lot of what you'll see in my 20 years outside of school, I did graduate in 2003. So it's almost about 20 years ago, was a lot of the learned experience. So I definitely, applaud all of you guys for actually taking this class, asking questions, learning a ton about entrepreneurs that you see. They're not probably likely the ones, that you hear about. So I would definitely dig into podcasts of how I built this and things like that. It's really interesting the path that people come from, and I'm excited to share my own. So I was really excited to actually dig into design. I mentioned to you, I started as a bio major, really knowing that there was a thinking there were only really five core paths in terms of career when I entered school. And so it was really exciting to see that Davis had a design program. And so when I entered that, it opened up an entirely different new world for myself. And so I did want to emphasize that it was environmental design. So took a ton of design classes from, illustration to design thinking, but also with the lens of environmental. And it's great to have had that. I know you guys are probably highly focused on our environment to date and where we stand in terms of a lot of issues that I would say are more prompted and pronounced, in every industry in terms of climate change. So I will say that it was always sort of the back of my mind in terms of my studies. I also mentioned I did a minor in marketing. So from a understanding of branding as an entrepreneur, you have to really know that everything is about how you speak about your company, your brand. And so no matter what, even if you have or have not taken any design courses or brand courses, it's really important to kind of understand, that everything is about how you speak to your either customer, user, consumer, you name it. So it's good to be able to at least take some of those classes if you haven't already. I went, right after school, I think it was second day after I graduated, I went straight out to New York. It was very important for me to be amongst individuals who challenge themselves. So I wanted to get out to where I was being most challenged. And I knew that if I was going to be in design, I needed to start that path and start to understand, where that level of standard needed to be. And so I went out to New York. It was a very, really eye-opening experience. I think just being around the hustle and seeing people compete with themselves was a really, really great grasp early on in my career. I did a lot of, I worked 4 days and then did an internship for 3 days. And so, I know today it's probably so different with you guys having the ability to do remote things. But I would say that, curiosity is probably your greatest strength. The more that you can really dig in and be in front of an individual, whether it be a internship, apprenticeship, or really ask questions and kind of dig into a career path you find interesting. It was, you know, I got firsthand experience by just being in front of the individuals. So I did, I did design. I wanted to go into design. And so I did that actually, worked for Anna Sui, and then also did, you know, a side job as well to pay my rent. And then soon after that, I did sort of marketing within the design industry. And then after 4 years, left back to San Francisco. And then while design wasn't as competitive, I actually started into visual design. So creating space. I worked for Levi's for a couple of years and went back and forth. And it was a natural progression. Again, because the design, actual physical design, was not as competitive, I wanted to understand the environment of how to brand a specific product. So it was really good training for myself. I was really good at it. And then it kind of led me into, you guys will see that there's no generic path to success. I would say that sometimes you start to see what you're really good at and you kind of fall into it. I then, you know, started taking side projects, doing some interior design, and then fell in love with the subject matter of real estate and asset management. And so to myself, it was just, it was always like an interest that then drove me into full excitement. And then an opportunity opened up where I could see myself really gravitate towards that. So while I did study design and not necessarily the economics or asset management, I jumped into it because I had a lot of heavy curiosity in terms of the built world and how things were, real estate was exchanged. I did the design for a lot, this real estate company, and then moved into more asset management because I wanted to see what were the controls and levers of actually building out not only an entire space, but the value add you can increase in terms of that space. As you know, anyone who's in the economic space, it's really macroeconomics. You're looking at how you improve the value of something. You guys know, in terms of real estate value, you know, something that's wholesale, it takes, you know, many, many people to be able to actually improve, you know, that from a blank slate, open slot, to actually, you know, jump in there, from an architect to, you know, the contractors and builders to designers, and then, you know, actual agents to sell the product and things like that. So I knew the inner workings of actually what built out an entire space. And then aside from that, I was always, you know, a designer and creative at heart. So I actually had had built out, you know, my own fashion company on the side as a side hustle, just to entertain my sort of creative appetite. And, you know, alongside that, I always wanted to get into physical space and, you know, sell my product to boutiques. And I saw that it was really difficult as a small entrepreneur to be able to do that. So I would go sort of door by door to different boutiques and try to sell my product there. And, you know, it was, they usually took product from either New York designers and whatnot. And so then I would go straight directly to the real estate side and say, great, what if I just opened up a full store? And I saw how broken that piece was and how inaccessible it was to actual entrepreneurs to be able to open up a full store. The price range I'll kind of share with you guys, if you are a young designer, you know, what they're looking for is your credit, if you've been in business for 3 years, profitable for two, and if you have, again, a credit line, or you have some revenue of about $250,000. I did not. So that was a really eye-opening experience. And the other path, instead of it being going direct to consumer and opening up your store, would be going wholesale. It takes about $50,000 to be able to do that route in the beginning. And then opening a full store is about, you know, $250,000. So about $250,000. So those two were not options for, again, a young entrepreneur like myself, who was, again, ensuring that I was getting my own apartment and things like that. So it just, it seemed like it was, there was a broken piece in terms of being able to follow that dream and actually, you know, have sort of this side hustle grow. And so this is about, I would say, like 2006, 2007. And so, why I asked if you guys have enough time, but you know, a core piece of it is that I saw that as there was an opening. The recession hit in 2008. So I'll kind of fast forward to that. And, you know, the impact of the recession really meant that, you know, there was, and you guys probably know that there was a big housing crisis that also happened. And so what was happening in the real estate side was that there was an increase in vacancy. And, you know, again, for anyone in the economic space, like really understanding what are the patterns that are happening from a macro level, and then what are the inner workings of why that happens, right? And so real estate, you know, everyone focused on the residential space. I was looking at the commercial side. I was seeing that there was an increase of vacancy. You know, it was skyrocketing and doubling. So the average was about 2%, it grew to 4%. And then by the time 2012 hit, it was about, it was close to 8%. That's very, very high for it to skyrocket and double, you know, within a 4-year period. And so at the same time, around 2012, there was a rise in a bunch of marketplaces like Etsy, Square, you know, all of these enablers, tech enablement, to be able to create, again, entrepreneurship. And so I was kind of seeing that there's two sides of the equation. One is tons of vacancy. Two is that there's tons of more entrepreneurs. Why is it that there was no fit? Why weren't more entrepreneurs going into physical space? And so that was my first clue into building out something that would drive an entire inception of this match between online going into the offline world. And so I built out with a couple co-founders something called Storefront. It is more of like a multiple listing site now, but what it was the first of its kind. So if you guys, anyone who knows or are interested in real estate is done by a lease. It's always been done that way. It has not changed in hundreds of years. And it was always done that way until about 2012 when Storefront, when we came about and we started to really disrupt the language around, you know, what a lease could be. And so we were looking at, and we did a lot of work with legal and cities and figuring out what would be the right compromise. And so we created something called a license agreement. And again, this predates, you know, it feels like it's so long ago, even if it's 10 years ago, but pop-ups and things like that, you guys might hear more so today, did not exist. It was a dirty word for a lot of commercial real estate side. And so what we did was we drove that language into more demand. And so all these brands, you guys probably know Warby Parker, Away, you know, these guys were all growing. And so I got to work with them in the early days of their inception and them kind of digging around and saying, great, how do we actually achieve mass again, understanding of our consumer and adoption from that consumer. And so at that time, 2012, they were looking at whether or not they do actual, you know, build out stores or what to do. And they were trying to test that price point of $99 if they were only online. And so what we did was, I don't know if you guys knew that they did a bus tour to every single college in 2012. And that's when we tested the price point. And so that was actually the first start of many where, you know, we introduced them to the idea of going to physical space and then being able to open up. And now they have hundreds of locations. But just like every, and I don't know how much or how often the word used for direct consumer, but that's something that lots of, again, entrepreneurs are now seeing. So that means that they're marketing directly to their consumer. Everything predating around 2010 was there was two ways to do to sell your product. You either went wholesale or you went into a physical retail space. Direct to consumer in terms of selling your product via, you know, online business was not really existent. So I'm kind of giving you guys sort of the push and pull of these two sides and why it became a marketplace. So Storefront grew. We became really known to direct to consumer brands. And then it became, you know, more enforced by these larger institutions of real estate like Westfield, Brookfield. Some of these you guys may not know because they're East Coast based, but some of them are international, but essentially big real estate conglomerates were seeing that there was a bigger appetite and the growing percentage of 4 to 8 to 12% and now 16% of e-commerce players means that there is more money spent on, again, purchasing online. And so, you know, there was actually more appetite for people to have interest and, again, growing vacancy. So we did that. And we actually, you know, sold in 2016, which was, it was a really fun, you know, part of the journey, as well. And that was actually to a European sort of lookalike company that acquired us. And then we skyrocketed and grew into a global company at 2016. So I took a hiatus for about 2 years and left to build out Westfield's experiential program. So if you guys ever go to San Francisco, there's something on the fourth floor called Bespoke. And so at that time, also kind of timelining some of the key I would say trends that were happening. You guys know of the company WeWork. So WeWork was happening on the East Coast. And then every single, again, real estate conglomerate was trying to figure out how to utilize, again, you know, some of the vacant space. And so because I had all of this experience in building out experiential, so we created that and we blew out 40,000 square feet. And from the asset management side, I was able to then project out what we could actually design from, you know, a trifecta of events, co-working, and event and experiential space. And so that was then carried to multiple portfolio properties throughout, and now it still exists today. And then I went over back to storefront again after they were acquired. I ran the US and grew us from, you know, we were at three cities to now we're in, you know, about 10 different countries. I'd written their ultimate pop-up guide, so doing some copywriting stuff. But it, you know, the startup journey, super, super exciting because you get to wear many, many hats. And I had the blend of being able to do business development, doing operations, doing a lot of different things. So as you guys, you know, look into entrepreneurship, really get to know what are the things that are really exciting and easy for you. But I like to be a generalist and always, you know, be curious enough to know what are the engineering's doing? What are the, you know, product individuals? What is marketing doing? And so, you know, the different levers that are pulled, because at the end of the day, to be a founder, you know, to lead a company, you have to know the core strengths. Of course, you'll be doing hiring, training, you know, and all of that piece, they all work together. And so I think you kind of do it with your friendships today. Everyone, if you guys know sort of the core strengths of individuals, either in your family or in your friends, it's a really good starter to say, hey, am I fit for entrepreneurship? Can I actually see where people's core strengths are? And then that then, so about 2019, I ended up leaving Storefront because we were kind of in a great path towards growth, but there's two different, I would say, mindsets and what scale means. And, you know, the new CEO, he wanted to be able to really just scale based on the current product that we had. I'm a diehard product individual, and I love building for users. And so what I mean by that is that I'm almost obsessive about how, you know, a user digests and retains the product. And so I'm more of a, there's kind of two sides. There's multiple ways to build a business, but I would say some products are used by scaling and getting multiple users in a mass capacity and almost as in terms of volume. And then some really look at it as, do I have high retention of that user? And, you know, some would say that maybe that there's different ways of doing it, but I look at it as more sound, right? If you have 100 users and all 100 of them love them and they refer, you kind of have this really nice network effect that is core to your consumer base. Some people look at it as like, great, I'm going to market it to everyone. I'm just going to grow to every city and country in the world, and then I'll get mass user adoption. And so you'll kind of learn a lot about that in terms of the different ways to build a company. I understood that for me, the path was always about, what am I building? Why am I building it? And is it the best of its ability to actually capture and retain that audience or user? So I eventually left 2019. And so that kind of gives you the period of me saying, great, I know that there's a product that needs to happen. Storefront, we built a product. It was all locating vacancy for these direct consumer brands, but most of them are venture backed, meaning they have loads of money to spend on being able to design out of physical space. I was still getting, you know, we saw about 90% of requests that were not actually getting served in the market. And so to me, that was a big, big indicator that something in the market needed to happen that was going to be a version that actually addressed a lower risk, lower price problem. And so that's, you know, again, always looking at like, what is the macro version of this economic issue that you can solve for? And so that's when I started to think about what, you know, what could something look like? And so as someone who was very, very, again, interested in being able to solve the larger real estate issue and the access of real estate, I then started to speak to a lot of the brands I had worked with, and I'd worked with hundreds of thousands of brands at that point. So I knew that the ones that were underserved were the ones that I wanted to serve. And so that began the idea of retail. And so the company in its infancy, you know, it was really about being able to say, great, what would it look like to lower the price and lower the risk and, you know, being able to ensure that we had more resources and education around it. And so that then started, and we actually started to pull together, you know, some wireframes of what this could look like. And then the pandemic happened in 2020, as you guys know. And it was the most horrible thing that could happen to real estate at large, but it was the best thing that could happen because it only further emphasized our mission and thesis that more and more small business entrepreneurs who are overlooked in general needed something and a home to actually, you know, operate their business. And so vacancy rates in New York City at downtown Soho rose to 38%. That's the highest it's ever been in the history, you know, of I would say commercial history of real estate. And, you know, that's a couple, 100% increase from what I had shared with you guys previously. And so that, you know, gave me a huge indicator. And then of course, a lot of the brands I had worked with that you guys probably know, away, all these guys were trying to negotiate their lease and were getting displaced and kicked out. And that they're venture backed, right? And then I have a lot of brands who are friends who have businesses, and all the ones that I have, you know, either been to bar owners, things like that, who I knew they were struggling. And so I gave them a lot of optionality in terms of license agreement, being able to negotiate their lease with their landlord, things like that, but also knew that there was a huge issue. And so we accelerated our build. So while I had actually done a lot of it, you know, with, it was like a 3-person team, and we were looking at it more from like an ideas and being able to then vet it through with a lot of the brands that were interested. We accelerated, you know, last year in the early or late 2020 and then early 2021. And then we actually we bootstrapped and then started to raise. And so we raised about $500,000 for pre-seed. We're looking at a really strategic seed round, and we're going to be working with, you know, institutional investors. So yeah, that's kind of, and then this is where we're at. So we have a really, really exciting journey ahead. We have a soft launch that's going to be in March of later this or next month. And then we will do an official launch. So you guys will see there's really static page in terms of what we're doing, but you know, we've built all the back end. And so we're actually moving to production at the end of this week, and then we'll have our soft launch. And that means that we have a cohort of brands that in pilot, and there we have 150 brands, all loyalists giving us feedback. Oftentimes there's, again, so many ways to build a business, but oftentimes people put it into the ether and start to see traction. You know, because I'm not a first-time entrepreneur, I knew that it was really important to build something that people, that all of our users were giving feedback on. It saves a lot of time, and it saves a lot of marketing dollars where you're not, we call it spray and pray, but you're not spraying and praying, but rather you're answering the questions and actually dictating your product build based on the user feedback. So we'll be launching officially at the end of fall, early winter. So you guys will probably hopefully see some great press around that. In the meantime, you know, I know you guys had shared a ton of questions, so I want to make sure that I also give you guys the floor too, but any specific questions around what I shared?
Yeah, so Chris was interested in what challenges you face in disrupting the industry, because you have made a lot of firsts. So I can't imagine that being the first is always easy. What kinds of challenges did you face?
Sure. I don't know how many of you guys have either worked with a real estate agent, maybe looking for your apartment, or have spoken, you know, have had your parents very stressed out about buying their first home. It is a very, very high stress industry. And then tackle, you know, add on that, tack onto that, the commercial side of it. It's in gridlock. And so, you know, I would say when that happens, it became almost this, the incentive for me to actually disrupt and get really excited about something that is, has been, you know, much of the same. And you guys remember, or I'm not sure if you remember, but I remember very clearly in 2008 when Airbnb came up. I remember very clearly, you know, when WeWork came up, I know when Uber came up, and it was exciting time to actually see entrepreneur and individuals take something that was never done before and be able to turn it on its head. But it became sound because they understood what they were enforcing for the user. And so, and that's really it, is always be really clear what your key drivers are. There's going to be thousands of people who say that it doesn't make sense, but it doesn't matter. You know, like if you, it's always like the first five people. If you have that five people, it grows to 100. 100 people grows to 500. And so I think being able to ensure that, like, what are you solving for? So the disruption side of it, we were clearly disrupting real estate industry at large. We had a lot of unfriendly landlords who were saying that we were, you know, sort of ruining the industry, but it had to be shooken up. You know, you guys probably will see, and as you start to, you know, pay rents, pay mortgage, things like that, it's a very stuffy industry. It's something that it's like the generic, you know, increase of your lease. Why does that happen? Why does it happen? Right. So to me, it was always about curiosity and then gathering again enough proof points to show otherwise. And that made it really easy to actually disrupt it. So we gathered a ton of demand from e-commerce entrepreneurs and brands, enough to be able to say, great, if they don't pay attention to this growing e-commerce online business, the status quo will be vacancy. The status quo will be, you know, you guys see headlines of retail is dead. It's not. We are in a built world. It just needs to be, you know, reinvented, configured. And so that's essentially what retail is solving. So using a lot of, you know, key touch points, and I'll kind of, I can share with you guys more inner workings of how the product works and our AI and what we're using to be able to do so. But it's going to support the sort of built world at large. And so we hope to be able to then partner with landlords, but more on the civic space, even, you know, I would say from either contractors to urban developers, and be able to say, great, the demand in the online world, it actually sits in the physical space. So you guys, in terms of your university, you know, no one's asking, surveying you guys, hey, would you like another Jamba Juice, or would you like another, you know, project, or whichever ones you guys have over there right now, but no one's asking. It should be. It really should be, because the consumer should be able to dictate what is, you know, sort of the new generation of appetite. And so that's kind of the functionality of what we're creating. And so that might not be what we share upfront in terms of our initial value, but it is what we believe is going to be the core value. So we speak a lot about something called spatial equity, which is a term that we've actually, you know, really garnished a lot of interest from, you know, investors and venture funds, because they're really interested in how we're going to reshape the new generation of how the built world is done. And so what will new cities look like? What will neighborhoods look like? How can we reinstate communities to be able to alert what the consumer demand is? And so, as you guys know, that there's so much data floating and getting captured as you use Alexa or your, you know, phones, things like that. But it's not actually then pushed to, when you walk around, what's the dictation of a neighborhood that you might want to live in the future. And so that needs to be then addressed. And that's a lot of the things that we'll be solving.
So you mentioned your tech. Can you tell us a little bit about the tech behind your product?
Sure. Yeah, so we, I'm excited. I'll speak to just a bit, but I think being able to have even, if you guys have brands that you're working on to really log in and see the actual features, it becomes exciting. But I'll kind of give you the rundown of how it's split up. So we make it super, super easy. So what we've done on the front end is be able to have something called just a quiz on both sides. So you sign in, your brand interested in maybe a space, and maybe you are a first-time entrepreneur. We make it super easy to dictate, you know, how you kind of get across. And what we do is you have a quiz. And so obviously the back end, we're collecting some of the information, like, are you a first-time founder? How big is your team? And so these things dictate. So about, you know, it's been about 20 years that I've worked with brands channeling and addressing their main either objectives or their concerns. And so I've kind of done this knowing that at the back end, it actually spits out a couple of key information for me. So obviously, if you have a smaller team, that means you have less resources. That means you have less money to be able to put into physical space. And so what it spits out for me is the cost of the space, right? Same thing if maybe you have done it multiple times and what you're looking for is higher traffic space. So great. And what spits out for me is that you're someone who wants to, you know, have a more engaging space that maybe has staffing to push and sell your product. And so that's essentially what we're doing as an engine on the back end. So we're using AI to actually push that and create that matchmaking. A lot like, you know, I'm sure you guys know Tinder or any of the dating apps. What they do is to create an engine on the back end to make it seem like, you know, your distance and location and geolocation is all sort of matching and fitting. That's essentially, we're adopting that same sort of engine and feedback on the back end to make that into a recommendation engine. So our phase one is to create a recommendation engine. When you do a marketplace, it's really important to understand the look and feel for the user. If I did an open sort of selection process, and it's kind of the same as a dating app, right? If you gave everyone option, you sort of run out of option over time. And we do know as, product people is that sometimes choice is the death of decision, meaning people get, you know, paralysis, decision paralysis. And so we know that really for us, we're arming the user with the key points to say, great, we took your quiz and we're giving you the best option. And these are available to you right now. And so then we're also saying, you know, that it's kind of a ticker that it's like, great, these are what's available. It's going to be, you know, this is kind of really hot right now. And so almost using the e-commerce online format of when you purchase something, you see that there's only three left or two left, right? We're kind of creating a gamification of that of that space and saying, great, brands, like, jump on it right now. And so that's kind of the first phase of it. We have an open chat system where we're then, you know, it's really fluid, so we can actually capture a lot of the key questions. We built that into the FAQ. And then, of course, there's the push notification for different events that are happening. It being Black History Month, we ensure that a lot of the Black-owned businesses are being highlighted for the spaces that we have. And then you're able to quickly book, rebook, and then we're building out a lot of the core services on the back end of the offline side. So what are core guidelines for, you know, sort of spacing, introduction, shipping, things like that. That's the core functionalities. Certainly, if any of you guys are specifically interested on what that all means and the inner workings, I can always speak to it offline.
Awesome. Now, Nazeeba has a core question for you. So sure. This process of being an entrepreneur, being a founder, what has been the best part of it for you personally?
Ooh, so many great learnings. I would say that the biggest indicator is your appetite to learn. There's no such thing as failure when you're an entrepreneur. It's really just, you're regurgitating sort of this appetite to learn at all times. The hunger to want to be better, is a really, really key aspect and characteristic for an entrepreneur. You know, having paralysis doesn't solve anything. So, you know, being able to now, as you guys are, you know, venturing into, you know, what does it look like to actually, you know, the next 4 years, I think it's super important that, you know, never sit too long with either a disappointment or, you know, feedback, negative feedback. Everything is a sort of a turning point to be able to drive it into something better. And so, you know, I always share with team members that, you know, great, you can come to me with a problem, but what's even better is come to me with 3 solutions. So I would definitely start to do that now. If you guys, as you sort of dictate, you know, all of the world things that come at you, and even do this with your parents and, you know, your friends. But if you can think of 3 solutions by the time that sort of that crushing feeling of the problem kind of attacks your inner workings, you're an entrepreneur, because you have to think on your feet. You have to be able to be ahead of everyone. You'll get, you know, so many questions based on your users, you know, your investors, people who want to challenge it, competitors, you name it. So if you can start to actually build that muscle, it's the best muscle to build.
Awesome advice. All right, I have a question from Ilias. Ilias is curious about how you manage your multiple interests, because in addition to retail, you've got women in prop tech, you're on the advisory committee. You're a founding member of Stand With Asian Americans. How do you find time to do all of these things and lead your business?
I would say that it's more about, you know, again, the beauty and strength of being an entrepreneur is that you get to dictate how you spend your time and who you get to work with. And so, you know, much of what I've learned is that I always wanted to work really fast. So I did go the route of working for, you know, large companies. I did go to the route of even startup. And I found myself always wanting to solve faster and quicker and having an incentive based on my own rhythm. And so that's, you know, I do wish, and not that in, you know, there would be, I would ever turn back time, because it's all the learned experience from all of that. But I do think you guys have an opportunity now to really strengthen that and be able to ask yourself, hey, do I do that too? You know, it's sort of like when you're in class and you're always the one sort of asking questions and pointing out like, why does this happen this way? Great. If you can solve it, you're an entrepreneur. You know, and so I would say that it's me having the appetite to solve the world's issues and problems. You'll see that, you know, being women in proc tech, I was the one of thousands and thousands for, you know, 20 years when I would go to conferences and speak about prop tech. And so the real estate, you know, in terms of the ownership of commercial residential, it is very, you know, one-sided. And so, every industry needs multiple individuals to be able to create a more sound infrastructure. And so that's, you know, women in prop tech, it was a natural progression. We needed to be able to see and actually, you know, invite more curious individuals, male and female, but, you know, to be able to come into the space and understand what is prop tech, what is this world. And so that was a natural progression. And then many interests, you know, that I have, Stand With Asian Americans, it was, you know, I mean, the pandemic created a huge fallout for, you know, Asian Americans. And I wanted to be able to solve that as an injustice. It's hugely important. And it's, you know, safety and the security of any individual is, you know, should be a number one concern and right for any individual at any stage of their life. And so, you know, we're doing a lot of amazing, incredible things to be able to drive education, resources, and funding for a lot of initiatives that already exist and the ones that are being created today. And then also on the policy side as well.
Awesome. I have a second question from Ilias.
Sure.
So this time, this is about space and location. So you have worked in both New York and San Francisco, two popular places for companies to be founded. if someone is sitting out here who is a potential founder, do they need to be thinking about going to one of these key geographies in order to build a business?
That's great. We, you know, you guys even more so live or are integrated in a remote world. You know, it's definitely not necessary, but I will say that, you know, just like my experience of moving straight to New York immediately and diving into that curiosity, as you know, with your relationship with instructors, with just about anyone, that quality time and that FaceTime, it drives the dynamic that you'll never be able to replace. So I do think even, you know, getting out there and really getting a feel for the landscape of whatever city you're interested in being part of. If you are interested in tech, you know, I think San Francisco, you guys are so close. You're right there. Definitely, you know, dig in. There's so many entrepreneurship, you know, centers or sort of tech startup incubation programs that are available for a lot of you guys. So you're right there. You know, New York to me, it's there's a completely different culture that I really, really love about its hustle. And you also get to see so many, you know, such a diverse amount of individuals, the way that they think, the way their mind works, the way that they are driven. And so I knew that for myself, I was kind of, you know, a split. My brain is very New York driven. My heart is very San Francisco driven. So I needed that for myself. But do what's right for you. If you're more of an introvert, the likelihood of wanting to be at the center of New York City and the tussle may not be the case. You can do a lot by emails and curiosity through there. You guys have Zoom, so there isn't really the need. But, you know, I would say just like apprenticeships or internships, the in-person really provides the most amount of experience that you can have.
So Joshua has a question about team building. So what do you do? And so we're assuming that you do something to make your team feel included and productive. And if you do, what do you do to make that so?
Sure. So I'll do it based on sort of two ways. Right now, our team is actually all remote. So it's interesting because we have half in San Francisco, half in New York. And then we have a bunch of developers all over the place, some international as well. I look at it as the best way to be an entrepreneur is being a high communicator. And so, you know, we do have a running cadence of one-on-one meetings, and then as well as addressing core topics or, you know, we call product sprints. You know, being able to, we don't overly meet. I think that is a core issue of everyone moving into the remote world that I see as like Zoom exhaust, where people are just kind of sitting there and getting bored because someone said there's a meeting time. But always making sure that, you know, for us, culture is about optimizing our time. Everyone has a bunch of stuff to do. We know our incentive is actually to build a really, really incredible core product. So I never make people sit on a call just because for the sake of being on a call. We have very, very key agenda and incentives and objectives for, you know, the team on a bi-weekly basis. And then we kind of dig in, and it's really about being able to say, great, what can we help solve for? So we kind of have a really core team understanding of that. You guys will build out your company culture, what's important to you. Some people like to, you know, work slow. Some people like to work super fast. Some people like, you know, really dig into that. It's going to be, the culture is always based on the drumbeat and the heartbeat of its founders. So, you know, definitely start to ask yourself, what kind of company do I want to build? What kind of founder do I want to be? What kind of, you know, product or impact do I want to make in the world? And then you'll start to kind of build out, you know, the culture that way. Hope I answered that one.
Yes, that was helpful. All right, final question comes from Tram, and it is a piece of advice you would give to students who are considering launching a startup. What would you say to them?
Right. I would say go for it. I, you know, it's, there's so many resources out there that we did not have even an ounce of today. But, you know, also don't get locked down by all the things. There's, you know, I remember sometimes I would get podcast fatigue, right? There's so much to learn. And there, you know, before digging into so many bios of success, right? You can have one path versus another and versus another. Actually find someone that aligns with your core spirit or, you know, something that you believe in, whether it be from your actual cultural background to, you know, your core beliefs and values, and of how to build. I would say that, you know, in my time in 2010, the idea of like, you know, hiring slow and firing fast. And, you know, there were a lot of these like jargon topics that were happening. And so it built out a very specific culture. You know, there were a lot of sort of volatile startup styles, you know, where it was a lot of this like, great, we're playing ping pong and things like that. I would say that we're kind of farther and there's more diversity in regards to what a startup looks like. Definitely get aligned with, you know, what you're building and why you're building it before, you know, the most challenge is that you get some funding and then, you know, you're more money, more problems, right? So definitely know why you're building it because you'll have to answer to that 100 times, then thousands of times, and then a billion times. And so I would say if you are doing anything in the startup realm, know who you're answering it to. Definitely. I mean, we know that we answer to the users, but there's so many different types of companies out there. Some answer to the investors, some answer to, you know, different philosophies, but I would say know what you're solving and what you're answering.
That's awesome advice. Well, thank you so much, Joy. Please, everyone, join me in thanking Joy.
Thank you, Dawn. I appreciate it.
It was great learning from you.
Fantastic. Well, good luck, everyone.
Enjoy that weather.
Thank you, Dawn. I'll speak to you soon.
All right. Bye-bye. Yeah. Bye.